Imagine you're in the mountains of North Israel. A gentle breeze is whistling softly through the valley. A herd of goats is running around, and the sound of their bells and their colors is like a playful jingle in the middle of nature. The shepherd of these goats is not a regular shepherd. He's not thinking about the regular things that shepherds think about. Instead, he's thinking about code, and his mind is busy trying to process complex algorithms.
Hey hackers, today's guest is a very special type of person, not your regular entrepreneur, and definitely not your standard developer. I'm David Zentner.
And I'm Sagi Schreiber.
And joining us today is a good friend and a side project hacker. He's actually one of the members of the first batch of the Side Project Accelerator. He's an entrepreneur, but currently works at a large company, a developer, and a serious autodidact.
Ladies and gents, it's our pleasure to present to you the colorful mad scientist, Tal Perry.
Let's get hacking! Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Hacking UI podcast. We are joined today with the one and only Tal Perry. What's up, Tal?
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here today.
Awesome to have you. So, Tal, for those who don't already know you as well as we do, actually, we go way back, Tal. I think 4.5 years now we're friends.
Almost five, yeah.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, where to start? So, I'm Tal. I'm the boyfriend of Maria. Proud owner of Jessica the puppy and Jesus the kitten. Day to day, today I work at Citibank. I do research on kind of the mix between behavioral finance and the credit derivatives. So I'll dive into that a bit later. I have a side project that I've been working on recently of automated transcriptions. It's called Smart Scribe. It's going to hopefully make transcription life much easier for all the people that need it, like you guys. Aside from that, I've been to Burning Man twice. Maybe 17 years ago was the first time. I'm active in the local Midburn community.
17 years ago?
Maybe my math isn't that great. No, 15 years ago.
15 years ago, you've been to Burning Man?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Pioneer.
Yeah, it's been a while. I like techno and beer and programming.
So I should mention that Tal, Sagi and I both met you about 4.5 years ago when we were in the Multa startup and you were working in TechLoft, the co-working space with us too. And I think back then you were in the middle of what was a side project turned startup, right?
That's quite true. So I think back then I was finishing my degree at Tel Aviv, did a degree in mathematics. And sometime along the way, I kind of figured out that I'd figured out the stock market. So I'd been working in finance as a side job for a few years at kind of a local private equity firm. And eventually I figured I cracked the market and I sat around and I looked on the internet and I taught myself to program. And I built an algorithm and then I was like, shit, I'm going to be rich. So I found investors. And I think we guys met when I was kind of right between writing the code and finding people to put some money in it. And I think that process took a good 6 months or so. And then another 6 months kind of to get it into production and running. And it turns out I hadn't quite cracked the stock market as I thought. So the algorithm almost broke even. I was very hungry for that period, but I think it was an amazing experience, and both because it was an amazing experience, and it really kind of put my professional life and I think my personal interest very much in track. Like I discovered I like to program and I like finance.
Yeah, well, let's back up a second here. Hold on. You're telling me you didn't know how to program before you jumped in and started basically a startup doing algo trading and programming with a serious algorithm?
So I knew like basic C, like the stuff you learn. I did like computers in high school. So, and I did a course in university, but like really basic stuff. And then the rest of it, I just kind of figured out along the way. Like Google's a really good friend.
No fucking way. What do you mean Google? Like where?
What do you mean where?
How did you learn to program like that? Like did you take an online course or just like?
No, like you need to do something. Like today, I need to map an equity to a particular function, right? So how do you do that? Like, so you ask Google, how do I map things? And then it tells you, well, there's this a data structure called the map, and this is where it lives. And then you're like, all right, you try and use it, and then it doesn't work, and you ask someone why, and you know you do that 100 times, and eventually, oh shit, I can program now.
So I'm gonna go learn Chinese. Come back to this episode.
Yeah. I think that's the way to do it, right? I had a girlfriend once who was like obsessed with learning Arabic, and she came to Israel and she didn't know a fucking word, and she just stopped Arabs on the street all the time and spoke Arabic to them, and she was driving them nuts. She was a horrible troll. But in 2 months, she could have fluent conversations. Like, we would go to Arab neighborhoods and she could walk around and talk to people fluently in 2 months. It was unbelievable. And it was just because she was absolutely persistent and she just chased knowledge from people all the time. And I think Google, the internet, Stack Overflow makes chasing knowledge really, really easy. But essentially, it's something we can do like everywhere, right? You can ask people all the time, and even if they think you're annoying, you can still do it, and you'll still get the knowledge you want.
That's really interesting. I mean, as long as I've known Tal, one of the reasons that I love hanging out with Tal is that he's not afraid of anything. And I think he has this kind of like belief that he can always execute and always get shit done. And Sagi, it's actually a lot of what we were talking about recently, this kind of fear, this lack of fear, and this belief of like commit now and carry out later.
Yeah. What do you mean commit now and carry out later?
Basically, you say, I don't know how to program. I know a little bit of C here and there, but I'm going to take a very serious thing about the stock market and maximize it to my benefit and build an entire startup around it based on being the only programmer.
I
don't know how to program.
I think it's kind of like a mix of confidence and stupidity, or maybe arrogance. Like, a lot of times, I think in general, we like trivialize problems just because I want to get there. It might be really hard, but like, I don't care because that's where I want to go. And so you trivialize the problem and then you just figure out the solutions along the way, right? Because...
Yeah, totally. And actually, David and I today had a very interesting discussion, and we tried to break down why we believe so much in the commit first, carry out later approach, and we try to break it down in order to teach it to others. So we came up with two things that you have to have in order to have the commit first, carry out later approach, or to carry it out. So one thing is get your mindset right, and the other thing is get your effort right. So if you get your mindset right, then it means that you believe in the way that you're doing, you believe in the fact that you can solve it. You're confident that, you know, it's just possible. You don't know exactly in detail how you're going to solve it, but you know that you can solve it. And the second thing that you can't go without, it's the right effort. So you have to really put in effort to actually solve it, to actually do it. So one doesn't go along without the other, but that's how you get.
I think one of the things I really like about what you just said is that you say the right effort. So effort alone isn't enough. Like, this is something I'm constantly learning to do better. Like, just working really hard, I used to think was amazing, and sleepless nights and, you know, white weekends and whatever. But you need to make the right effort, like optimize your time and manage yourself correctly and make sure you're always working on the right things and not the trivial. Yeah. And so it may not be the key to success, but it's definitely like avoiding unnecessary work or making the right effort is definitely like a key to avoiding failure.
Yeah, totally. We put it as like identify the challenges that you have, because you have some challenges in whatever challenge you want to take on, whatever like problem you want to solve. And then try to already think, how are you going to overcome those challenges? So exactly what you're saying. Yeah. Cool. Nice. All right.
Yeah. All right. So let's fast forward a little bit. So after, I think it was about a year or so, you left the algo trading business to work for a larger company, right?
So yeah, I didn't leave the algo trading business. I left my algo trading thing to go work at a bigger algo trading company. So I think at that point, I was poor and starving and kind of sick of it. And also, I think I had reached the maximum that I could really learn by myself without maybe a mentor or someone guiding me or like a higher goal. And I got a very interesting and attractive job working at a company called Fluent that did the infrastructure for high frequency trading on FX. So they were solving a lot of really interesting problems. We did things that went really, really, really fast. Like, we measured our performance in microseconds, and we moved like a lot of money every day on the stock market. And it was all written in code. It was kind of mind-blowing to see a system that was that big, like, and work on it and even make a significant contribution to it. Like, it was really cool.
Very cool. But after a little while, you went back to the startup.
So yeah, this is true.
And there's kind of a pattern here that we've talked about a little bit in your career, right? That you're kind of, that you're always seem to be hunting that startup kind of entrepreneurial goal.
Yes, this is true. I think like there's a few things to it. One is maybe the biggest thing in startups is the freedom. Like, you get to make your dream and kind of run after it, and it can be fluid. which is both like a blessing and a curse, in the sense that like if it's a fluid dream, then sometimes you're just chasing around your own tail. But it's really nice to be able to have a dream or a goal or to build something and be proud of it and kind of grow it. And it's something I'm always chasing. And I also hate authority. So, you know.
Oh, there's that.
There's that too, right? So, but this also happens in a startup. Whenever you're not the CEO, you have someone as authority. Even if you are and you have investors, right? You always have someone to give them that you need to report to. You're always going to hate them. Or at least I will. But I think companies are great both because they give you the opportunity to live a normal life in the decent pace, establish yourself financially, make sure your personal life is on track, and learn a ton. Like, you know, the big companies or the bigger companies I work at have amazing people, and a lot of them, and tons of knowledge and tons of opportunity for growth. So it's, I think, not just nice, like, or comfortable, also really important to go there. Like, when I left my last startup, people made fun of me, or I also kind of felt strange leaving, the startup world for the corporate world. And I work in kind of a neighborhood in Israel called Ramat HaChayal, which is it's like a big meat factory for sausage. You know, there's like thousands of high-tech workers going in there, like a big sausage factory, just pounding out code. And it's a big cliche that kind of entrepreneurs go there to die. And
Ramat HaChayal feels like that too, because it's like just one street.
It does.
It's like one street full of restaurants and high-tech places.
Right. So I work on the next block down. And luckily, like, I ride my bicycle there instead of taking the bus. Once in a while I do, and you really feel like you're just being shuttled into the slaughter on the way there. But then you get to, you know, you go to work and you're surrounded by brilliant people and you're working on super interesting problems at unimaginable scales. So it's really gratifying, actually. Like, I was kind of worried about it, and definitely my self-image was worried about kind of feeling like I was a startup world and I've kind of given up on shit. But it turns out, no, like, not even temporarily. Like, I'm definitely having a lot of growth and seeing a lot of amazing things that you just don't get to see. You don't get to solve problems. Like, I work at one of the biggest banks in the world. You don't get to work on these problems at a startup. You only get to work on these problems at one of the biggest banks in the world.
Yeah, that's really cool. But still, you have kind of pursued your entrepreneurial interest through side projects now.
So yes, this is very true. So I think, as I said before, I'm now working on automated transcriptions, so kind of as a service. So it's funny how this came about. As I said, I ride my bike to work every day, and I listen to podcasts all the time. And I think I've had a series of side projects before that I thought, all right, well, you know, the internet, everyone's making money on the internet. I'll make money on the internet too. So, and I realized all these podcasts, everyone has like a commercial with a promo code. So I figured, oh, well, I'll tap into that. I'll run a speech to text algorithm. I'll rip out the promo codes and I'll make a coupon site, right? And and we'll bring some traffic there, and, you know, we'll sell ads on the coupon site, and, you know, I'll make $500 a week, you know, it'll cover beer or something. And then, so we did the math, like, our group of friends, we have a WhatsApp group that we bounced it around and we talked a bit and realized, like, that's not a really good idea. No way, but transcriptions, we can do transcriptions with this. And then you realize it's, I think, a very interesting technological problem to work on, and the market's huge and there's space in it to operate. And I kind of dived into it, kind of realizing that in sort of iterations of thinking and starting to work on it, that, oh wow, this is kind of everything I want in a side project.
Cool. So what does your company think about you working on a side project while you're at, you know, a large company?
So my company is really big. So there's not one thought, but my
manager, they don't even know.
My so Citi has kind of a policy that where if you're working on an outside business, you have to declare it. And it was very important for me to, you know, not be my traditional Israeli kind of shushu hackery self, but be straightforward about it. And I told, you know, I think I started off by kind of doing talks about the technologies I'm using. So I did a lot of work on serverless. The whole platform is serverless, so we can dive into that later. But, like, kind of, I don't have any servers. I have infinite scale, a lot of really cool stuff that Amazon's providing and Google's getting into. And, you know, if I was talking before, one of the big ROIs on doing side projects is the learning. So this is kind of the initial goal that I put in was I want to understand serverless technology and build something on it. And I started off by kind of gently introducing the idea that I'm working on something on the side by just giving technical talks within the company about, all right, here's serverless technology, and this is what I'm doing with it. And, you know, it's great for general projects because of this, this, and this. And then everyone kind of knew that I'm working on something on the side, but nothing threatening. It's a side project. And then, you know, eventually I told my manager, look, you know, I have this side project and I want to have people pay for it because, you know, it works. And then there's a whole compliance process within Citi. So I had to declare it and, you know, had my manager sign off and his manager sign off. And it went up all the way to the regional director of the technology unit, and the compliance people interrogated me about it.
So can I ask just, you know, go back to the beginning of that process.
Sure.
How did you present it to your manager that you're working on a side project that might make money?
So I think I kind of eased into it. Like, I didn't just come and say one day, look, I'm building a business. But, you know, I said what really happened was, you know, I'm working on something on the side. It's consuming a lot of my time and it's really interesting. And here are the technologies I'm working on. And eventually I said, hey, look, I have this thing and I think it's going to make money and I want to put it, you know, I want to ask people to pay for it. And then it was very much a natural progression. I think sometimes people have a fear that their side projects are in competition with their work. And, you know, if my side project goes amazingly successful, then essentially it is, you know, if it becomes some huge thing, then, you know, I'll probably leave Citi and go work on it full time. But as it stands now, it's just something I'm doing on the side. It's like a hobby that I believe in, that I'm passionate, that I want to grow. But I don't feel that it's like a threat to my company. I don't really feel guilty about doing it or that I'm doing something sneaky or something like that. And I don't think my managers do either, because I don't feel that way.
I think this is an important thing you said, that a lot of people fear that their side project will be a threat to their current business. But I mean, really, the biggest threat to your current employer is another employer coming and just paying you more. You know, you can leave, and if in that situation, you don't bring any value to your current employer at all. But in the situation of a side project, you know, which only in, like you said, in the case that it super succeeds and you find that you're not happy or, you know, getting satisfied from your current work, then you leave. But the whole time that throughout this process, you are, like you said, bringing a lot of value. And you mentioned that you started giving talks at the company. I'm really interested in how you started doing that. I think that's something that a lot of people would like to know, because, you know, how did you start the process of saying, like, I want to present, and then getting people on board and getting people to come to it? And
so I think one of my colleagues told me one day, you like to talk, don't you? And so that's at the base.
And that was the first day he was working there.
Yeah. Yeah, she figured me out very quickly, which is true. I like to talk and I have a lot of things that interest me and I want to share with the world. And I sat down with my manager and I told him more or less that, oh, I'm doing all these things and I'd love to share them with you. He's like, look, you know, you can just send out an email and, you know, give a talk and people will come.
But is this something that was already, is this like a formal process that was being done at Citi, or you, Tal Perry, started something new?
No. Like, this existed. There's definitely like a thing where employees who have something to say, you know, they can send out an email. We have a lot of talks about a lot of interesting things, from like crazy programming techniques to like proper courses in clean code and solid design to a guy who was a dog trainer in the army about training dogs. So all sorts of topics. Like, even like my thing at work is I work with a credit derivative. So like mostly kind of insurance on bonds that might go junk at some point, right? And I think next week, it's the Jewish holidays. I'm giving a talk about the treatment of credit, about like how people can go bankrupt and what do you do when they do go bankrupt, treated in the Talmud and kind of the Jewish legal text, and kind of showing how they actually solve a really like crazy problem that is still applicable today. So in the Talmud, they tell this story about a guy who's married to three women. And he promised one of them like $50 and another one $100, another one $150. And he dies and he doesn't have enough money to pay all three of them, right? Even though he promised. And then, so how do you pay back each of these women? How do you divide what's left? Right? And this is, no, but this is a serious question. But
yes, this is a very serious question.
No.
Very serious.
But you think about it, you guys.
Every one of my three women will get what she deserves.
all of your 10 women. But no, you need to see the parable here to finance, which is that instead of three women, this is just like a company issuing a bond to 100,000 people, and it goes bankrupt, and it has to pay all these people whatever they own, whatever they bought out from the bond. How do you divide what's left from the company, right? So this is called establishing the recovery rate of a bond. So how do we know how much each person is? And if I'm buying the bond and I need to take bankruptcy into consideration, how do I project how much money I'm going to get back if the company does go bankrupt? And this is still an active field of research in finance in general. But it's amazing to see the Talmud attacked it 2,000 years ago or 1,200 years ago. And the best part of this problem kind of remained open until an Israeli economist, Uman, attacked the problem with game theory and kind of showed the one and only solution after 1,200 years of people trying to tackle this this passage in the Talmud. Yeah, so that's my talk at Citi next week.
Oh, okay. Okay. So wait, so you're giving like weekly talks? This is like...
I think I try and do them, like I set goals with my manager at the beginning of the year, and I think I set like goals to do like 4 talks about credit and 4 talks about programming throughout the year. Kind of, I think I wanted to very much establish myself as someone who's kind of a knowledge center within the world of credit, within our technological organization, and within the world of Python programming, which is kind of my forte.
A thought leader, if you will.
If you will, yeah. Yeah, you could use that term as well.
But it's very cool. Okay, so you're working at like a large company, so you have essentially an audience that you can tap into to do these talks for and to present in front of. But I imagine you're also doing this with your side project outside of work too.
I should be doing more of it, probably. So I think this is one of those opportunities where thankfully I like to talk and you guys let me. I recently enrolled in the Side Project Accelerator, and kind of I think it's forced me to do something that I want to do, which is commit to writing content online or sending a weekly newsletter and a blog. You can visit me, by the way, at talperry.com. That's talperry.com.
Yeah, we'll put everything in the show notes.
So that's kind of an opportunity. It's made me put my voice out there more, which is interesting because like I don't have a strong goal of having like a wide presence generally, like having a, I guess what you guys call a personal brand. Like I feel generally I'm anonymous and I kind of enjoy that. Like I like...
Oh wait, what do you mean by that? I mean, you said that on your own, you took the initiative within your company to start giving talks. I mean, this is not trivial. This is like a pretty big deal.
Yeah, this is not being anonymous. This is like the complete opposite of being anonymous.
So I think you guys personally know me. So sometimes I'm very flamboyant and they like attention to make noise. But then like the things that I do, I don't know why. And maybe it's probably not right in terms of like a P&L. But I just kind of like the things that I build to be of their own accord, like to exist kind of independently of me. Like I like that there's no mention of Tal Perry on SmartScribe, even though I'm very proud of everything I built and I want to tell everyone about it. But the product is kind of independent, or there was Midburn, Israeli Burning Man before. So I was part of a big group that built one of the bigger camps at Midburn. Kind of, we built a big dome with a cuddle bottle full of teddy bears and people loved it. And it was a great success. And I really like that it was a great success kind of on its own. It was, even though all of us had very big egos and a lot of big investment in building this thing, the outcome and the happiness of the people and the enjoyment people got out of it was very much independent of us. It just kind of stood alone.
I have to stop you for a second. I think you need to explain to the listeners, first of all, what is going on at Midburn and what is Burning Man for all those that do not know.
Ah, shame on you if you don't know. No, just
because we're jumping around between, you know, your side project at work, your presentations at work. And I think you just touched on something pretty interesting there, that you're doing basically an additional side project, if you will, that's a very serious time commitment that you spent, I think, for the past couple of years. You've done some work on this at the Israeli Burning Man.
Sure. So
first, yeah, give us an idea. What is the Midburn Festival?
So I guess the best way to describe it is Israeli Burning Man. So Burning Man, if you don't know, is, you know, in the desert in Nevada, they build a big statue of a man and a big city around it, and it's kind of like no law, anything goes. Amazing. People do art and craziness and insanity and really like the epitome of freedom. And Midburn is kind of the Israeli version of it. which aside from the scale, it's much smaller, I think holds a candle to the actual festival. So, and a big part of both Burning Man and Midburn is kind of that the community or the people that come there make the festival. Like, they don't provide anything. The festival doesn't provide anything except for infrastructure. And the festival is just what the people bring to it. So as a camp, we brought in this big cuddle puddle, and that was a thing, right? Like, it was
a what?
A cuddle puddle. Yeah, good point, right? Not everyone knows what that is. So we built a dome. It was a 10-meter diameter. And we filled it with a few hundred teddy bears, like big stuffed animals, and carpets. And then people could just come around and sit in the shaded dome, cuddle with the teddy bears, or cuddle with each other. And then, yeah. And it, like, I have to say, I was on the kind of the logistical side of thing, like doing shade and
getting teddy bears.
Someone else got teddy bears. Like, there's a lot of work getting teddy bears.
What kind of time commitment was this? I mean, it sounds like you're putting together a massive production here.
So as a camp, we were 70 people. And I think we were like 10 people kind of driving this thing forward. And it was much more of a time commitment than any one of us expected. Like, we all got into it. Kind of, we had drinks one night and a few people kind of sent, an email or a message to their friends, come and have a drink and we'll talk about this camp. And we were like, yeah. And we raised a bunch of money really quickly. And then a few other were like, oh shit, but we have this commitment. Now we need to make this shit happen. And the more we did it, like, the more time it took. But on the other hand, it was a lot of fun. Like, the whole team that worked on it was amazing. And the camp in general, like, working together was great. And it was, I think, for me personally, very nice to work on kind of this distributed, voluntary team and be part of something kind of abstract. But it was a huge time commitment. Like, I think we were all exhausted by the end of it.
So what did you get out of it? I mean, you're doing this in addition to your work, in addition to your side projects. What are you getting out of all of this?
Pleasure. It makes me happy, like...
I think it's just being part of a community as well. I mean, you're part of a group. You're doing stuff together.
That's part of what do you do stuff for, right? Like... you can measure life in P&L, right? Does it have economic benefit for me or not? And it's important, but economic benefit is just important for funding, the stuff that really matters to you and makes you happy and makes kind of, life worth living. And, building a big cuddle puddle in the middle of the desert makes life worth living, And Credit Derivatives, while really fascinating, don't make life worth living.
Yeah, no, I think it makes complete sense. But I want to jump back, if it's possible, to your experience in the Side Project Accelerator.
Sure.
And also the fact that you said that on one hand, you want to be a thought leader, and you did say that. And on the other hand, you said you like to stay anonymous and that you don't like your name on your products. And so one thing I just want to say, I think having your name on products can be really beneficial because people that see your products and see a name, not exactly on the front page, maybe in an about page, which the about link is only on the footer or something, but people just like that see a product, sometimes they want to find out who's behind it, that actually humans are behind it, like people with credibility. And if you put your name somewhere there, that could be really helpful. Second thing is the being anonymous / thought leader, it's a clash for me. Like, can you explain that? I mean, what your standpoint? Do you want to be thought leader or not?
I'm confused. I'll give another maybe Midburn example. Maybe while I talk about it, I'll be able to figure this out. But aside from the cuddle puddle, I worked with one other guy, and we built a big tree out of plastic bottles. So it was like 4 meters tall, and it was full of LED lights.
Okay.
And I did the animations for the LED. So it was kind of a big tree in the middle of nowhere that just kind of floated. And we both worked on this really hard, after hours. And I think both of us are really bad at personal marketing in the sense that this thing stood there. And it was amazing to see, you go in the middle of the night, 3 a.m, people are hugging the tree and standing around and looking. And it was really satisfying to see people enjoying the fruits of my labor. But it was also very frustrating. Like, no one knew that I had anything to do with it. Like, I felt like I got kind of no credit for what I created. So in that sense, it kind of frustrated me that I wasn't smarter about maybe getting what I wanted out of the project that I did. Like, it was definitely in some sense a mistake. And in another way, though, it's kind of satisfying to see the tree fully independent of me. Like, I built something and it's on its own now, and it's just alive and kind of bringing happiness to the world.
So I think it touches on something that a lot of our audience has, mm-hmm. basically. And that's exactly that kind of game between, I want to be a thought leader because I have value to give to the world. I have stuff I want to teach. I have stuff I want to build that will bring value to people. But on the other hand, no, I don't want to be like, you know, the person that is out there like, oh, look at me, you know, I'm a thought leader. And this kind of clash is the exact clash that I think we're trying to solve because, yeah, you should be out there. And yeah, your name should be on top of everything you do. Because if your name is out there, then you are considered a thought leader, then you are promoting yourself, then you can build more stuff that will gain more exposure and bring more value to people. So on the other hand, if you're like, no, I want to stay anonymous, that's the thing that you think this decision is because of you want to fight your ego and you want to not have ego and you want to like, you want to stay humble and that's okay. But I think that actually hurts your main goal, which is bring value to people.
I think that you're probably 100% right. And like, you know, if I had to, like, you know, hearing myself talk, and I thought about this before, but I really, you know, probably, you know, even though I can say kind of nice words about my ego and independence and bring happiness to people, all of this is true. But probably there's some psychological hang up there that kind of prevents me from feeling comfortable with marketing myself aggressively, or what I deem as aggressively. And I should probably address that more seriously.
Well, one of the ways that I like to share with people that I think that helped me get over it, and we talk about it in the Side Project Accelerator too, is to not tell people that this is the best way to do something, but just to kind of share your experience. It sounds like you kind of did that at work with your talks. And just to say that, look, this is what happened to me. This is what I did. This is how I felt about it. There may be other ways to do it too, but not try to aggressively attack people. Their way is wrong. Your way is right. But I'm sharing my experience, and then you can kind of get over a little bit your fear of putting yourself out there, or your fear, or your fear of like giving into your ego.
So, like, I don't know, the word fear, I don't think is the right one. It's not really giving into my ego. Like, again, and maybe this is just me bullshitting, but at least, you know, when I bullshit myself and kind of semi-convince myself, then there's something satisfying about having something that's independent of you. Like, I don't know, like, I guess like a child is one day you want to see it, you know, it's hard for you to give up on like on the connection, but it's kind of an independent thing. It's on its own. You influenced it, you made it, but it stays on its own.
I think that I can really connect to what you're saying, because when I opened Pixel Perfect, my Hebrew blog, which was 5 years ago, mm-hmm. I decided that I don't want my name everywhere on Pixel Perfect. And I just put it, you know, in the about page only and just like kept it there. And made it like kind of like not about Sagi Schreiber, but just about Pixel Perfect Magazine as a body, which is something bigger than just me and something that is out there and more independent and by its name. And come to think about it, one of the decisions that we made in Hacking UI, I think like about a year ago, was to put our names on the logo. And once we put our names, we made a decision to put the names on the logo, like on the top of the site. We said, that's a decision that we want to put our names out there. We want to put our names out there and be heard and be seen as people. Because one, once people understand this blog is driven by people, then, you know, we'll respect it more. And second, we're not marketing ourselves. Like, I don't think we're marketing ourselves. Please call us out on this if we're wrong. But I don't think we're marketing ourselves as like in an aggressive manner. We are putting ourselves in front of people's faces, because we know that obscurity is the enemy of all people who want to be thought leaders. So people might really love your content. You might have a lot of value to bring to people. But we see, if we stay, you know, behind the shadows, nobody will even know us. Nobody will even know what Hacking UI is. And that's kind of like even the thing that we saw in San Francisco, David, right? Like, we were in San Francisco giving two events. And in those two events, almost nobody that have been there have known what's, you know, Hacking UI. And all of the thought leaders that we bring into the show, I mean, most of them didn't know what Hacking UI or who Sagi and David were before we, you know, we talked to them in the show.
I think what you're getting at is, I totally agree. And I think what the thing that most got me is that when you have your name out there, when you develop this kind of personal brand or become a thought leader, it allows you to do side projects and work on products. And if they don't work out, which in many cases they don't, I know from personal experience, I know that you do too. I know that Tal, you know as well. We can get into that in a second, but we've all worked on millions of side projects that have failed. But at the end of the day, if you have some sort of personal brand, and if you're talking about what you're doing, then when your side project, if it does fail, you're not left with nothing. You're left with something that you're starting a level higher on your next thing. And after that one, you work on that one, you're starting even a level higher on the next one.
So I'll take the parallel path to what you guys are saying and maybe contradict myself even more. Is I think about, like, I've raised money 2.5 times for startups. At Citi, I do a lot of internal sales. And I realize a lot of times, you know, when you're selling a startup or an idea or kind of an MVP, then really what you're selling is yourself. And as time goes on, maybe more people know me and I have a slightly larger track record and maybe a bit more of a brand equity, I notice that things get easier. And also that I feel like today when I go to I came here from a meeting when I was trying to onboard a distributor onto my transcription project. And I realized as much as I was selling the product and the technology, I was very much selling myself. Not as an object, but kind of as the brand, what I'm bringing, and kind of the added value of, you know, someone else might be doing this technology, but, you know, Talper is here and doing that. I think I've kind of developed a very keen awareness of understanding that I have, like, I as myself have added value to bring to the table, and it's important to leverage that. Like, sometimes I felt at the previous startup I worked at, I kind of overdid it, but with Pitch to Investors, where our CEO was kind of a proper CEO, very tight, very elegant, very everything you'd expect from an excellent CEO. And I kind of came, maybe because I am a bit that, but kind of the cluttered mad scientist, kind of, you know, where I talk, I'm excited about algorithms and, you know, I just want to talk about data. And in some ways it's true, it's very me, but sometimes I kind of also overpushed it on purpose because that's the brand that I'm trying to put out. And I think that is, you know, even though I like to stay anonymous and keep things independent of myself, still I realize it's a very important thing in pushing the things I want to push forward, right? Is putting in, you know, you're not just buying my technology, you're buying me, or you're investing in me.
Bringing your extra value to the table,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that the person that you are.
It's cool. I mean, I'm still like fascinated by what you said before about giving the talks to the company. And I think that this is important because maybe this kind of dissonance that you have, and I think so many of our listeners have, between being a thought leader, putting themselves out there and not giving into like kind of just an ego push, is in the way that you put yourself out there, the way that you market this personal brand that you were talking about. Maybe it doesn't have to be in, you know, like a gigantic blog that has your full name on everything. Maybe it can be in these talks that you're giving or in other speaking engagements, or maybe it's speaking at conferences, or, you know, as you said, you went to like a very private meeting, a business meeting, but you were essentially selling yourself. So maybe there are other ways to sell yourself and kind of build this personal brand that aren't as frightening, if you will, for some people.
I think that maybe it's like about being passionate. I'm best at selling myself. I'm passionate now. I'm passionate about, I don't know, service technology and transcriptions and I don't know, and my girlfriend, right? And I can talk about these things and kind of over them because I'm passionate. I think that passion is addictive, and or I don't know. I like the Talmud too. So if I'll get up at Citi and talk about that, it's not like I'm not doing it to push my personal brand. It doesn't kind of, I'm doing it because this stuff is so in me that it just kind of spills out. It's like, I don't know, like an overflowing glass, and it needs to come out, right? And
yeah, and that's exactly the point where you are authentic, and that's exactly where you push yourself. And yeah, I dare to use the word push yourself in front of people's faces because you're passionate and you want your passion to come through onto other people. Yeah. And that's exactly the value that you have to bring into the world. And I'm saying that because I want everybody who's listening right now to also kind of like grasp it. If you're out there and you want to, like, you're listening to this, you know, to our Scale SI Projects show, and you're really kind of like into creating a personal brand, but on the other hand, you're also having that kind of like, okay, but I'd like to stay anonymous thing. I think we got to put the stay anonymous thing on the side, because once we bring our value, like our passions, onto the surface, then that's where our names will be heard, our value will be delivered to the other people on the other side. So that's one point I really, really want to make. And I want you also, Tal, to like really, you sound like you're already doing it, but let's say your transcription site, like tomorrow, I want to see your name there already.
I'll keep it in mind.
Challenge accepted?
Perhaps. Challenge considered.
Cool. So, Tal, I want to ask you a question about the transcription thing. You explained a little bit about what you're doing with the side project now. Mm-hmm. And we mentioned before, and we didn't even get into all of them. We've actually worked on like several side projects together even. But I want to know, so what are you doing differently with this one? Why is this going to be the one that's going to succeed?
So I think, first of all, like, what is success, right? This is something that I've learned to ask before I get into things. And then, you know, success can and should be on a scale. So with this thing, I kind of got into it. Remember, like, it was the first idea was just to rip coupons out of podcasts and bring traffic, right? And then success would have been, you know, oh, I make some money, but nothing big. But then I kind of realized, well, you know, I'm going to work with a lot of interesting things, and it's an opportunity to learn. And I think, like, I set myself goals, I'm going to get into this, and I'm going to learn to do serverless technology, and I'm going to get my front end development skills up to par. And for me, that's huge ROI, both because I like it. Like, I like learning. It makes me happy in terms of my personal career. Like, because I'm a technologist, like, I feel I should be up to date and be able to do stuff. And I think in all the side projects I've ever done, like, you know, because none of them have been tremendous business successes, but all of them have had very high ROI kind of long term, because I've picked up significant skills that I've implemented both in my day-to-day job and leveraged to get into the next place, right? Like, cool. You know, my first side project, I was doing algo trading. I didn't know how to program in the beginning. I just taught myself because along the way, and I was starving for like a year, right? I didn't have any money. As an aside, I had a girlfriend at the time who forced me to take a vacation. Like, I scheduled for 2 months down, and by the time the vacation came, we'd broken up and I was broke. I couldn't go anywhere. And the only thing I could do, I called a goat farm and I went to herd goats for a week. And, you know, which is a great skill too, because now I can like milk goats and herd them. And, you know, I know a little bit about the cheese making process. So even that had some ROI. But, you know, even though that process of doing the side project sucked economically for a while, I think it definitely put me on track, both kind of in a personal way to find the stuff I'm really passionate about, and then to keep growing my career. So that's the first part. Like, what is initial success in this project? But, you know, what I'm really doing differently in this one is, because this thing is, as opposed to other side projects I've done, is very much geared towards a financial goal, right? Like, I like the technology, but I don't have an overwhelming passion to transcribe things. Like, I'm not curing cancer here. In that sense, like, this thing has a business thesis. This is the first time I've really approached a project kind of almost from day one, which is, I have a thesis. I believe that this is the market. This is what it's lacking. This is the kind of product that should go to it. I have a plan to iterate on that, and iterate in the sense that I have a thesis and I have steps that I'm going to take, and each one of them should either validate or invalidate the thesis. And I think that, I don't know if that will lead me to success, but it will definitely lead me to fail as early as possible. So as soon as I have confirmation that the idea doesn't work, then leave it. And as soon as I have, like, I spent a lot of time setting up metrics and tests for what is the right thing and what is manifesting itself as the right way to go, and consistently following that instead of kind of doing what I think most developers tend to do, is, oh man, this is an awesome technology, I want to try that now.
Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah. So avoiding that and kind of working more in an iterative process, it's always asking, you know, does this validate my thesis or not?
Okay, so everyone out there, give us like an actionable tip. It sounds like the main thing is you're iterating faster, mm-hmm. you're failing faster. Give someone an actionable tip about how they can do that with their side project.
So ask yourself, what is success? I think that's the first question that you should always ask. What is my success? And from that, break it down. So, and then everything you do, you should ask yourself, does this serve success or not? And I think if you do that, then you'll find yourself fighting with yourself constantly. Oh, but yeah, optimizing the CSS or this funnel, it serves success. Really, does it though? You need to be very candid and honest with yourself. Is this really the most important thing to validate my thesis right now? And then the other thing is, define failure in kind of a clear and very measurable scientific way, right? If I don't have this number of users by this time, or if I don't get to a particular number of paying users by this point, or if, you know, in my case, if my accuracy in speech to text isn't at this particular rate by this time, then this is a failure. And if it is, then it's not a success, but it's a signal that I should keep going and look for the next failure indicator. And you can derive that series of tests if you ask yourself, what is success? and then slowly break that down into sub goals until you break it into units small enough to kind of iterate on quickly. And it's, I think, something I'm getting much better at is actually doing that thought process in the beginning instead of kind of inventing it as I go along to affirm what I'm doing. So kind of having a list of things that I should be hitting or not hitting and having it ahead of time.
All right. And so it seems you're talking about, like, you know, working faster, failing faster, learning faster. Can I ask, like, you're in the Side Project Accelerator. How has that influenced you? What have you learned from being in the Side Project Accelerator?
So personally, I think the number one thing I got from it was just a big kick in the ass to put myself out there, which is big, right? Because I wouldn't have done it otherwise. Like, I wouldn't have taken the time to sit down and write content and set up a nice blog and maybe fix some of the shitty design that was on there. I just wouldn't have done it because I don't fundamentally care. It's not in my comfort zone, or it's outside of my comfort zone. So I just say I don't care about it and I don't do it. But kind of being part of the program and having assignments that I had to hit and kind of tangible goals, and I promised David I would do all the homework. So it forced me to get very much outside of my comfort zone and do it. And then realize, oh, wow, I can do this. I think the first post I put on had like 2,000 visitors from Reddit. And I was like, oh, my God, I have readers. And like people are, you know, and upvotes. And I was like, oh, wow, people care about what I'm saying. It was very satisfying. Like, I think for me personally, it was very big. Like, it was a very significant thing because I wasn't aware that anyone really gave a shit. And like, I always thought that doing it was distant for me for some reason.
All right, Tal, that's really cool. All right, so I have a question for you. And I know you're doing this really well because we talked about it before. But do you have any tips for anyone who's trying to get started and technically how to get this stuff done? You know, the side projects that you're working on. You have so many different ones and you're constantly building new things, starting new websites, and just kind of like spreading yourself all over the internet. So technically, give us some tips how someone can get this done today and without ruining their budget.
So my motto has become be cheap and outsource, right? And really, like, and the more tech literate you are, the more you can be cheap, and the more, I don't know, socially literate or business literate you are, the more you can outsource, and you should try and optimize on kind of being both. And I'll give a few examples, right? So SmartScribe, my current transcript, one of the things I'm really proud of is it's very, very scalable, even though it has a lot of very computation intensive things. And kind of in a traditional architecture, it would be very expensive to maintain something that could, you know, handle 20 users at once to do automated transcriptions. Even though most of the time you have no visitors. And you think about it, like when you launch a blog, when you're kind of establishing your brand, when you're just launching anything webby, like you're paying a lot of overhead just to have that presence, even though most of the time no one's on your site. And it's ridiculous to pay kind of an hourly rate or a daily or a monthly rate when most of the time your architect, your infrastructure is just sitting there idle, right? And today, one of the things that I really, really, really like is serverless infrastructure, which I've dropped this buzzword a few times over a conversation. And Amazon does this amazingly well, where you can basically deploy really small segments of code and you pay by the millisecond of runtime, which is amazing. Like, I look at my project that, again, has this infinite scale, right? I can, and, you know, if people come in, then, you know, I'll just have the function deploy and Amazon handles the whole thing. And I only pay by the millisecond of compute time. So, you know, on days or months when I'm kind of iterating or working on the product and I haven't brought in a new batch of users to actually try the thing, I'm not paying anything. And at the end of the month, you know, last month I finished with an Amazon bill of $2.91. Which really, really kind of serves being cheap. And maybe I kind of take it to an extreme, but what's really nice about it is that this kind of burn rate, there's no pressure to bring in income. So like, I don't feel that I have to bring in money soon for the sake of bringing in money. Maybe I want to bring in money for the sake of validating the product, but only as a signal and not necessarily because I have to cover my expenses. And that's great because it gives you a lot of breathing room and time to think about the product and the market and not be frustrated with every expense that you have because, you know, you're slaughtering them away. And then I guess the counter side of that is to outsource as much as you possibly can, right? Because even though money is expensive, you know, I work hard for my money, you guys work hard for your money, and it sucks to spend it on things that are frivolous, but your time is much more expensive than that. And anything that you can give away or put to someone else to do while you're building your initial product, even if it's not perfect, even if it doesn't fit exactly what you need to do, if it gets the core functionality done quickly and hopefully cheaply, then it's prices. And I give an example, like I set up a login flow on Smart Scribe, and login sucks. Like I do it with, login with Google and login with Facebook and login with LinkedIn. And usually you have to authenticate with each one of these providers and write like a piece of code that handles, you know, their particular interpretation of the OAuth process. And I found these amazing providers, Ufo, where basically, you know, you sign up and you say, this is my Google ID, this is my LinkedIn ID, this is my whatever ID. And you put a little piece of JavaScript in your code and that's it. You don't spend like 3 or 4 days implementing login flows, and they give you the CSS and the JavaScript and they handle the backend. You don't manage users. And that's priceless, because like I think about how much time I spent about just fixing login problems before you even talk about optimizing the funnel, right? Just getting the shit to work properly. And it's stupid because so many other people have done it. Why not give it away, right? Or if you look at something else, you know, lead generation, right? You know, I wanted to target podcasters in the beginning when I was working on this. I wanted to approach them. And my traditional, very, very cheap way of doing it would have been to, you know, go talk to friends and look at a list and find something. And then I just went on Elance and paid someone a few dollars to, you know, find me a list of podcasters who don't have transcriptions and might need them. I don't know, it cost me $20 and I got this huge list of leads, and you know, I sent out an email, and you know, the guy worked hours on it, and it saved me so much time doing tasks that A, I'm not good at, and B, don't make perfect or most optimal use of my personal skills. And the ROI on that stuff is immense. And I actually feel, personally, I feel I'm not good enough at outsourcing. I'm very, very good at being cheap, sometimes maybe to a fault, where I spend too much time on being cheap as opposed to outsourcing. But I guess the benefit of that is that I have a higher burn rate. Like I'm not panicked about money, and I'm working very hard on getting better at delegating and outsourcing and kind of saying, all right, this $100, it's $100, but I can live without it. And the ROI on the time that it's going to save me is more significant than the $100. Maybe, you know, if I think about it, I don't know, in a more accounting perspective, at least in the initial stages of the project, it's good to set aside a budget. And instead of trying to minimize your recurring costs, so try and minimize subscriptions to GitHub. You know, you can use Bitbucket for free for a private repository. Try and minimize what you're paying for hosting. You can use Amazon's free tier or AWS, or I don't know, Heroku has a very, you know, try and minimize your recurring costs and put all your budget on one-time things that you're testing. So if you need leads to get, you know, or if you need you know, people to test out your product, paid, or if you need some sort of annotated data, pay for those one-off costs and try and defer as much of your recurring billing far in the future.
That's a really nice idea. Let's say that again exactly. You said put your money and put your finances into the one-off cost and avoid the recurring fees as much mm-hmm, as possible. Mm-hmm. Avoid the recurring hosting fees.
Exactly. Because what that gives you is essentially you don't have to worry about, like, if you have recurring fees, if you have like infrastructure, you have to put up $100 a month, you know, just to start the day. That sucks, you know, because you're going to look in the future and you're going to be like, shit, I have to put up $100 a month for 6 months. And no one wants to spend $600 on something uncertain. But you can always cut away your one-off costs, right? So I won't bring in lead generation. Mm-hmm. So if you optimize in getting rid of recurring costs and instead delegate your time away mm-hmm. on the one-off things that you're experimenting with, you're going to get a lot of ROI, both because you're much more free financially and both because your time is much more optimized.
Definitely. And you touched on something else that I really liked when you were talking about outsourcing. This is something that Sagi and I are, like, you know, fully on board with, and we're teaching the Side Project Accelerator mm-hmm. also, do an entire lesson on outsourcing even. And it's basically this concept of don't reinvent the wheel. Like you said, you just said, your time is worth a lot of money. Your time is expensive and you should value that. And you shouldn't say, okay, I can do this little thing myself. Because in most cases, especially if you're a developer, a designer, you have technical skills, you say, I can build this thing myself. Yeah, what am I going to pay someone else to do it for me? but it seems like you're...
So I'll take it a step further. And every time I have a problem, the first thing I say to myself that I am stupid and someone smarter already solved it. And it's always true. Nice. And as soon as I say that to myself and remind myself, you know, be humble because I'm stupid, I go to GitHub and I find that someone else did something much better than I ever expected. And instead of writing it, I just do git clone and or npm install and I use that. And it extends
and definitely that's definitely the technical side of it too. And it extends to what you said, the non-technical side of, you know, finding leads and doing all sorts of even email tasks. We're doing this, you know, with podcast editing and other things that we're outsourcing now. All tasks that we did at the beginning ourselves, we realized how much time we were spending on them. Then we said, there's no reason to reinvent the wheel. Our time is really expensive. And when you free up your time, you're able to do more. You're able to bring, to give more to your side project. You're able to push your product forward, build that other feature, serve your audience, whatever it is you need to do. You're able to do that with your time.
So I was listening to Tim Ferriss's podcast a few days ago, and something really interesting is it was that he's a big fan of outsourcing, obviously, but something that he says that he likes to outsource processes that he's mastered. And I think this is the hardest thing for me in outsourcing at the moment is that I don't know how to communicate a lot. Now I'm trying to outsource design, right? I know nothing about design. Mm-hmm. I am so aesthetically inept. It's ridiculous. And you know, I've been spending, I thought I would get this thing done in 2 weeks, and I've been spending a month trying to optimize my communication with designers and understand myself exactly what it is I want and am I communicating it effectively. And one of the things that I'm really, eventually I've gone, you know, I'm kind of going back and forth in a process between doing mock-ups, which I know nothing about. I don't know what a mock-up is. I thought of the visual spec. I realized that, you know, if I put something somewhere, the designer is eventually going to put it in the same place. I thought he would use his own judgment. And I'm terrible at that. I'm good at developing things. And I think going between this process of doing the mock-ups on the one hand, but then concurrently trying to build the thing I want so that I can communicate, look, this is what I want. I just want you to make this pretty. So this makes it very hard for me to outsource, right? And I think one of the big learning things I have, and I'm sure many other people who want to get into outsourcing mail on task, is to master the task, like to be able to communicate it effectively and define the goals you want, the outcomes you want from the task in a way that your counterpart that you don't know and who's not sitting in the same room with you can execute without you having to micromanage them.
That's a good point. So how do you do that in a situation, like you said, with design or a skill that you don't know?
So this is an excellent question. And honestly, I suck at it at the moment. Like, I'm trying to learn. But really, I guess like everything else that I've kind of figured out in life is just through trial and error, right? You try it, you know, it doesn't work out. I tried outsourcing code. I didn't give deadlines. I didn't give a good enough task definition. And I got poor results in a long time. And eventually, you know, I got rid of the guy and I realized, shit, but it's not even his fault. You know, he wasn't a bad developer. I was a crappy hirer because I didn't give him time constraints and I didn't say exactly what I want. So
I think one thing that's important is that you have the ability to do this trial and error. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is like one of the biggest benefits of doing a side project, especially while you're in a situation like yourself where you're in a job that you like. Many people don't do side projects when they're in a job they like because they say that I'm in a job I like. Why would I do anything else? Or they don't do a side project until they're in a situation where they totally, you know, hate their job and want to quit. Or they do a side project and they say that I'm going to quit my job now and I'm going to take the side project and turn it into a startup and do it full time.
But like a side project shouldn't be related to your job. Like the relationship between your job and your side project should be zero. You're not doing a side project because of or despite you. You're doing a side project because this is fucking cool. And do you want to do it, right?
Like 100%.
And your job has nothing to do with it. You know, if one day your side project makes a ton of money and you can quit your job, that's amazing. But like, you know, you should be spending your free time, your leisure time, you know, your expendable time on the things that interest you and make you happy and you're passionate about. And not on, you know, compensating for shit.
I 100% agree. And I think that is an awesome point to take us to the end of this episode, because you just really hit the nail on the head there, that you should be spending your free time on stuff that makes you happy and stuff that you enjoy doing. Yeah. And that's really what a side project is about. And exactly like you said, that if in the future it's something that earns you tons of money and, you know, sets you completely free or lets you leave your job or whatever that is, that's great. But there are so many benefits of side projects. I think that we heard it from you here today. how you're benefiting from the side project you're doing within your own company, the one that you're doing outside the company, the one that you're doing at Burning Man and the Israeli Midburn, you know, in so many different angles, and each one has its own benefit. And each one is giving you, has its own return on its time investment, mm-hmm. its monetary investment. And each one, you know, you, like you said, you measure success in a different way before each one. So each one has a different measure of success, a different goal. And that's so important that they really, I think what people can take from this episode today and take from listening to you, Tal, is that there is so much of a benefit in doing a side project, and there's no reason not to start one today. It's not just, you know, your way out. A side project can give you so many different goals.
Just go have fun, you know? Mm-hmm. Have fun.
Cool. So, Tal, thank you so much for joining us. It was a lot of fun. I mean, both Siggy and I have known Tal for years, and, you know, it's been fun to sit down, Tal, and talk to you about business, side projects, you know, things that we don't talk about on a day-to-day basis just as friends. So this has been really cool. Now, Tal, tell everyone where they can find you and how they can get in touch.
So, yeah, I guess the best way to find me, my personal brand that we talked about, is go to talperry.com. That's talperry.com. And if you want to check out Smart Scribe, it's currently in beta. It's totally open and free. Just go in, log in, and you can upload YouTubes, you can upload videos, you can upload media, and you'll get the transcription to your email. So
they'll get if they upload an audio file, they'll get a free transcription to their email. That's correct?
Absolutely. So, you know, you can upload an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours of audio all at once or in chunks, and you know, you should get results in 10 to 15 minutes. Of whatever you uploaded. We support 80 languages. So I don't know if you speak Swahili or English or Bangladeshi or Hebrew or Arabic, you know, upload something and, you know, you'll get a transcription. And, you know, if you do use it, it's absolutely free. I would love to get your feedback. So you can reply to the email that you get it from or write me personally at tal@smartscribe.io. You can get in touch with me there and, you know, give me your feedback. Let me know what you think could be improved. Let me know what you love. Let me know what you hated, right? I'm dying to get any more input into this project.
Cool. So hackers, you heard it here. Let's put Tal's programming skills to the test and let's up that Amazon bill of his.
Amen to that.
All right, cool.
So Thanks so much, Tal.
Thanks again.
Thank you guys for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Over and out.
Hey everyone, Sagi and David here. Hope you enjoyed this episode and were inspired by that awesome story of side project success. If that made you think of your own side project, then we have something we want to share with you.
That's right. We are soon launching the second batch of the Side Project Accelerator, which is our very own program where we teach everything we learned while growing Hacking UI from a side project into a full-time gig that allowed us to quit our jobs.
The Side Project Accelerator is an online program which includes recorded lessons, live stream sessions with the most successful side project entrepreneurs in the world, and access to a community that will hold you accountable for getting your shit out the door.
But the program doesn't end there.
Yeah, when we say community, we mean you're going to become a member for life of a small but tight-knit and extremely active mastermind group of other side project entrepreneurs that will share tips, ideas, and provide the support needed for you to succeed. The Side Project Accelerator is entirely online, so you can join from anywhere in the world, and all live sessions are recorded so you can watch or listen at your own schedule.
If you're asking yourself, is this for me? Then I want to give you a little bit of direction. The Side Project Accelerator is perfect for designers, developers, and others in tech-related fields. You don't have to be a rockstar coder or designer, but we will push you out of your comfort zone, and you can't be afraid to get your hands dirty.
Also, you don't have to have an idea for a specific side project in order to join. And if you are already working on a side project but haven't yet figured out how to scale and monetize it, then the Side Project Accelerator is perfect for you.
You can learn more about the Side Project Accelerator at hackinguI.com/sideprojects. And since you're listening to our podcast and we really appreciate your support, you can get $100 off the price of the Side Project Accelerator by entering the discount code podcast at checkout. Now, registration is not open yet, but will open in a few weeks, and spots are extremely limited and we expect it to sell out quickly.
You can join the waiting list to be notified when registration opens, and when it does, you'll be able to use that promo code to get $100 off for the next batch. So again, that's hackinguI.com/sideprojects, and you'll be able to use the code podcast, just the word podcast, to get $100 off signing up when registration opens. All right, so that's a wrap. Thank you, hackers, for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed the show. You can find all the links and resources from this conversation on hackinguI.com/podcast. And just before we go, we want to share with you something that you might find useful.
As you know, we are voracious readers and consume a ton of articles, books, podcasts, and videos about design, development, and side projects. We curate the hell out of everything, and each week we send a short roundup email of our favorites. If that sounds like an email you'd enjoy getting, then we'd love to have you join our awesome community, which already has more than 20,000 happy members from all over the world. You can sign up on hackingui.com.
By the way, on hackingui.com, you'll also find some other cool stuff like the Side Project Accelerator, our 8-week online program in which we teach everything that we learned in the 3 years working and scaling Hacking UI as a side project before we quit our day jobs.
And you'll also find our resources page, which reached the top of the week on Product Hunt Tech, and our events section, which is filled with conferences and meetups for designers and developers.
Hey, D, don't forget the tees, man. We also got some cool t-shirts for designers.
Sugi, again with the t-shirts?
Hey, I designed those, but really, last thing, if you enjoyed this, we would really love to hear from you, either by tweeting at us at HackingUI or by reviewing the podcast on iTunes. Those reviews really go a long way and help us and even make our day.
All right, we'll see you next week, hackers, and remember to keep hacking.